This and every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
This is VOA News, reporting via remote. I'm Jeff Custer. Massive explosions rocked a military depot in the Russian-occupied Crimean Peninsula in Ukraine Tuesday, igniting fires and forcing the evacuation of more than 3,000 people. The large-scale blasts occurred at an ammunition storage facility in Moskoye, the second time in a week that explosions have occurred at Russian outposts in the territory it seized in 2014. Russia called the explosions an act of sabotage without directly blaming Ukraine. Ukraine did not claim responsibility for the incident, but some Ukrainian officials have hinted that their forces were behind the explosions. Speaking of VOA's Flashpoint program Tuesday, reporter Anna Chernikova in Kyiv said there was also a bombardment overnight in the city of Kharkiv.
Over the night, it was quite a huge bombardment of the city of Kharkiv, and probably the city of Kharkiv is the worst of this night, because as reported by the mayor of Kharkiv, it was hit by dozens of missiles, and 5 out of 9 areas of the city, districts of the city, were attacked. We have information that there is destruction of infrastructure and of the road in the city, but there is no information about the victims for the moment.
Meanwhile, a spokesman for the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said Tuesday, at the invitation of President Vladimir Zelensky, the Secretary General will be in the western Ukrainian city of Lviv Thursday to attend a trilateral meeting with Zelensky and Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan to discuss the Black Sea Initiative, the agreement that allowed grain shipments to once again leave Ukrainian ports. The Secretary General will then go to Odessa the next day to visit the ports which are being used for the initiative. This is VOA News. Longtime Kenyan opposition figure Raila Odinga said Tuesday he will challenge the results of the close presidential election using constitutional and lawful channels, a day after Deputy President William Ruto was declared the winner. There were Odinga's first public comments since Kenya's Electoral Commission Chairman Wafula Chebukati declared Ruto the winner with just more than 50% of the vote. Odinga spoke to his supporters in Nairobi, urging them to remain calm while the challenge moves forward. 4 of Kenya's 7 electoral commissioners Monday abruptly announced they wouldn't support the results. Earlier Tuesday, the 4 commissioners asserted to reporters the chairman's final math added up to more than 100% of the vote, and the excess votes would have made a significant difference. They also said the chairman did not give them a chance to discuss the results before he declared a winner. Now East Africa's most stable democracy faces weeks of disputes and the possibility the Supreme Court will order a new election. A mural painted in a synagogue in the northeastern U.S. state of Vermont more than 100 years ago and hidden behind a wall for years has been painstakingly moved and restored. The AP's Ed Donahue reports.
It's now known as the Lost Mural, painted by sign maker and Lithuanian immigrant Ben Zion Black in 1910. It shows the Ten Commandments with a lion on both sides. Rabbi Amy Small is at the Ojave Zedek Synagogue.
We had so many devastating losses as a Jewish community. So to be able to see this whole restored is also about how we are feeling whole and restored.
Experts like Josh Perelman with the Weizmann National Museum of American Jewish History says it's a rare representation of a kind of synagogue art in Europe that was largely destroyed during the Holocaust.
It makes it both a treasure and also a significant work, both in American Jewish religious life and the world of art in this country.
Damaged sections of paint have been restored and the entire mural was cleaned. I'm Ed Donahue.
The European Commission, the executive branch of the European Union, said Tuesday Europe could be facing its worst drought in 500 years as several European countries endure high temperatures and a lack of rain. European Commission spokesman Johannes Barkey told reporters in Brussels it's too early to definitively say as the drought is not over. But the Commission's current data suggests this year's drought was worse than that of 2018, which in turn was the worst since 1540. Drought is affecting nearly half of Europe, damaging agriculture, forcing water restrictions, causing wildfires, and threatening aquatic species. Repeating the hour's top story, massive explosions rocked a military depot in the Russian-occupied Crimean Peninsula in Ukraine Tuesday, igniting fires and forcing evacuation of thousands of people. Reporting via remote, I'm Jeff Custer. This is the Oasis.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehiyes Wuhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight,
we will be pursuing all constitutional and legal options available to us. We will do so because we regard the many flaws in the elections and the wrongs committed by the IEBC.
That's Kenyan opposition leader Raila Odinga saying he will challenge the announcement yesterday that he lost the country's presidential election. Details coming up. Also, Nigeria says thieves and vandals cost the country up to 200,000 barrels of oil per day. That's billions of dollars in lost revenue. We have these stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. A group of Kenyan election observers say their own tally of the presidential election shows that Deputy President William Ruto was the winner of last week's vote. The election outcome remained mired in controversy Tuesday as Ruto's main opponent, former Prime Minister Raila Odinga, said the official figures were null and void a day after four members of the Electoral Commission publicly disowned the results. Mohammed Yusuf reports.
The elections observation group, made up of 15 Kenyan civil society and faith-based organizations, conducted a pile vote tally as electoral officials verified and tallied up the vote counts from around the country. The group, known as ELOG, found that Ruto received 50.7% of the vote and Odinga, his closest competitor, got 48.7%. The group's tally closely tracks the result announced Monday by the head of the Independent Electoral and Boundaries Commission, IEBC, who said Ruto won a first-round victory with 50.49% of the vote. ELOG chairperson Anne Ireri addressed reporters in Nairobi Tuesday.
ELOG's PVT estimates are consistent with IBC's official results for the 2022 presidential election. In light of our assessment of the election day processes and given that IBC figures fall within the projected ranges, the PVT projections therefore corroborates the official results.
Ireri said observers noted an improvement in the country's electoral management systems, though she stopped short of declaring them sufficient.
Having observed the electoral process over a period of time, it is clear that we have made strides towards credible elections. The country still has a lot of work to do.
Meanwhile, Odinga spoke on live television Tuesday and rejected the official figures announced the day before by IEBC Chairman Wafula Chebukati.
The figures announced by Mr. Chebukati are null and void and must be quashed by a court of law. In our view, there's neither a legally and validly declared winner nor a president-elect.
There was controversy even before Odinga's remark, as four members of the Electoral Commission disowned the results reported by Chebukati, saying the vote tallying process was too opaque. Some legal experts questioned the legality of Ruto being declared the winner, given the split in the Electoral Commission. However, Joyce Majiwa, a steering committee member of ELOG, says the chair has the legal right to announce the winner.
With regards to the split, as I've already said, it is an unfortunate thing that they did not speak with one voice, but the returning officer, for the purpose of this, I gave an example of a polling station. There are many people who are in the polling station, but only the returning officer has the duty to pronounce the results.
Odinga and his supporters have 7 days to file a legal challenge to the commission and the declaration of Ruto as president-elect. Mohammed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
Kenyan opposition leader Raila Odinga today said he will challenge the results of the close presidential election after Deputy President William Ruto was declared the winner. Odinga's announcement brings new uncertainty to a country where last Tuesday's vote was widely considered as its most peaceful. Wafula Chebukati, the chairman of the Independent Election and Boundaries Commission, yesterday announced the results, but four of the seven commissioners have said they disagreed with the process he used and would not support his announcement. Odinga, who ran for the presidency several times, said he would pursue legal challenges to the announcement.
I do not want to fully address our strategies going forward, but suffice it to note that we will be pursuing all constitutional and legal options available to us. We will do so because we regard the many flaws in the elections and the wrongs committed by the IEBC as fatal to the process and the outcome announced by Mr. Chebukati.
Now, East Africa's most stable democracy faces weeks of disputes and the possibility that the Supreme Court will order a fresh election. Religious and other leaders have pleaded for calm in a country with a history of deadly post-election violence. Odinga joined them in urging peace.
I want to commend our supporters for remaining calm and keeping the peace, and urge them to continue to do so. Let no one take the law into their own hands.
We will continue to follow developments in Kenya's election in the coming days. Thousands of African migrants lose their lives every year as they attempt to make the perilous journey across the Mediterranean Sea to Europe, hoping for better lives. More often than not, those who make it face rejection upon arrival. Others have been displaced by conflict and drought at home. For more discussion on the subject, VOA's Esther Getwe Ewart today spoke with Mohamed Abdikar, Director General for the International Organization for Migration, East and Horn of Africa region. He handles the IOM's work in a volatile region marked by internal conflict in Ethiopia, the Al-Shabaab threat in Somalia, and rebel threats in Central Africa.
Thank you again for having me, Esther. Three main issues that drive us for migration in our region. One is the political instability that causes a large number of people to be displaced within their own countries or to cross borders. The second one is obviously economic disparity that we've seen with the COVID-19 pandemic that was going on the last few years. The number of people who've gone through the poverty, below the poverty line, has just increased. And the last one is climate change. And I'm more than happy to expand on those three issues as well.
Let's talk about that because it's important. This is happening. A lot of people think it's just a joke. Mm-hmm. But climate change has an impact on people. What are you seeing, especially in the Horn of Africa?
Right now, we have close to 18 million people who are food insecure in the Horn of Africa. And just in Somalia alone, we declared about a few days ago over 1 million people have been displaced because of drought. And we're talking about four consecutive rainy seasons that have not rained in the region. If we get the fifth one, we might come to a famine situation in Somalia. In 2011, we had close to 200 million people who died. So we might have even more people die if we don't do much more in Somalia specifically. But the drought is not just in Somalia. It's in Somalia, it's in Ethiopia, it's in northeastern Kenya, it's in Djibouti as well.
Now, you've talked to various government officials in the Horn of Africa, Central Africa as well. What do you see as the government's responsibility to stop this migration of Africans from their countries? And what does this do to their own people, their own countries, in terms of depleting the resources and skills from
I think one of the most important things about climate change, I'll start with that, because we just had a big Kampala declaration in Uganda where we brought in about 19 governments in Africa, including countries as far as Egypt, Algeria, Senegal, and Zambia, with the Horn of Africa countries and East African community together with the regional economic blocs, IGAD and East African community. And bringing them together was very much to talk about what do we do about climate situation in our region. First and foremost, what are we going to do about the drought? What are we going to do? Second, about adaptation. How are we going to adapt? Because it's going to be with us for a very long time. And third is about what can we do with the international community and how can we make sure that during COP27 discussion in Sharm el-Sheikh in Egypt in November, Africa has a message on mobility and migration in the region.
And very briefly, what does IOM do to help survivors?
Right now, we're providing shelter, we're providing water and sanitation, we're drilling boreholes, we're providing even transportation for Africans who are stranded in Libya, in Yemen, in Djibouti, in Somalia, back to Ethiopia. So we provide all the assistance required for our migrants.
That was Mohamed Abdikar, Director General for the IOM Programs in East and Horn of Africa region. He was speaking with Esther Getwe Ewart with VOA's Africa 54 television news program. Heavy rains and flooding have killed at least 50 people in the northern Nigerian state of Jigawa. The French news agency AFP reports that Youssouf Sani, the head of the state emergency management agency, said 27 local governments were affected. He told the wire service that among the worst hit was Kafin Hausa district, where 10 people were killed, 68 hospitalized, and over 1,400 displaced. 11 shelters have been opened. AFP also reports that authorities in Niger say flooding and landslides during Niger's rainy season have killed 32 people and affected more than 66,000 since June. The capital, Niamey, has so far been spared. The rains have damaged or destroyed more than 7,000 homes, collapsing classrooms, health centers, granaries, and shops. You're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Please note, we have moved our programs from voanews.com to voaafrica.com. There, you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. Find us on voaafrica.com. Africa's largest oil producer, Nigeria, says thieves and vandals cost the country up to 200,000 barrels of oil per day. That's billions of dollars in lost revenue. To combat the problem, Nigerian oil authorities have launched a mobile application for reporting the incidents and rewarding those who do. Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja, Nigeria.
Launch of the crude oil theft monitoring application took place last Friday in Abuja during the signing of renewed production contracts between the Nigerian National Petroleum Commission and its oil drilling partners. Authorities said the mobile platform was created for members of host communities in oil-rich regions to enable early reporting of incidents and spur immediate action from relevant security and government authorities. Whistleblowers will also be rewarded. During the launch, the NNPC group head, Mele Kiari, admitted that pipeline vandalism has become difficult to control. In July, Nigerian authorities changed its oil firm from a solely state-run entity to a commercial oil company. Emmanuel Afimia, the founder of Abuja-based energy consulting firm, says addressing oil theft is an important issue the new company must address to improve its earnings.
At this point, NNPC would be able to at least find solutions to the issue of subsidy, to the issue of inefficiency, to the issue of loss every year, because the effect would actually be felt by them. So I'm not sure they would want to continue with the way they've actually been operating the corporation. So this is really a right step in the right direction.
According to the NNPC, Nigeria loses 200,000 barrels of crude oil a day, or about $4 billion in revenue every year. Kiari said so far this year, the country has already lost $1.5 billion due to escalation of pipeline vandalism and oil theft at the Bonny Terminal in Rivers State. But Toyin Akinosho, publisher of the Africa Oil Plus Gas Report, says beyond launching an app, political will is needed to address the problem.
It's very important that the state hydrocarbon company itself is announcing this. You know? But it's not just a question of that tracking. It is actually how you deliver on ensuring that those incidents don't happen again. There has to be the willpower to deliver. That's what I'm interested in.
Nigeria is Africa's biggest oil producer and has been seeking to cash in on rising energy prices as Europe tries to wean itself of Russia's energy supply following the invasion of Ukraine. Authorities have revived decades-old trans-Saharan pipeline projects from Nigeria to Algeria and also from Nigeria to Morocco. Both projects are targeting European energy markets, but Akinosha says the projects may not be completed until a few years from now.
Whatever it is that we're even building will take a bit of time. You can't construct these pipelines that government's talking about. You can't deliver them in less than 3-4 years.
In January this year, authorities in Nigeria's oil-rich River State began cracking down on illegal refineries locally known as Bullfire. Many operators were arrested. Authorities say the government's oil and gas revenue target this year is now threatened by a production shortfall of 28 million barrels caused by oil theft between January and July. Timothy Obiezu from VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
The Biden administration says its new Africa policy is based on establishing equality, promoting open societies and democracy, and working towards pandemic recovery and climate change adaptation. During his recent tour, the U.S. Secretary of State touted these objectives and the new relationship between the U.S. and its 50-plus partners on the continent. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Washington.
Equality at last. That is what U.S. President Joe Biden's reframed Africa strategy pledges to the fastest-growing continent. Secretary of State Antony Blinken summed it up thusly during his whirlwind trip to Africa last week.
What we seek most of all is a true partnership between the United States and Africa. We don't want an imbalanced or transactional relationship. And our commitment to a stronger partnership with Africa is not about trying to outdo anyone else.
Except, Africa watchers say, two countries loom large. China, whose Belt and Road infrastructure initiative has crossed the continent, and Russia, whose foreign minister also took a recent tour of the continent to remind African nations of old ties from the post-liberation era. Krista Mackay is an associate professor of government and African studies at St. Lawrence University. She spoke to VOA on Zoom.
I think the shift in rhetoric is an important one, and also one that is really aimed at countering China's use of the term partnership, you know, economic development partners, that has been well-received across the African continent in terms of being more respectful.
The White House says this will be exemplified later this year at a revamp of 2014's U.S.-Africa summit. At that summit, then-President Barack Obama made a point of not inviting Zimbabwean leader Robert Mugabe, who grew increasingly authoritarian before his death in 2019. And he's not the only African leader to have served for several decades, a challenge to the U.S. policy of pushing democratization. Ebenezer Obadare is a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. He spoke to VOA on Zoom.
I think the United States is in a very interesting, you know, juncture here, where if you have to try and at least appear to want to have, you know, everybody around the table, even people that, you know, you rather not have around. So I expect there will be, you know, a lot of African leaders there.
And he said there is a real sense that this policy, while materially not too different from previous policies, carries a note of truth and reconciliation.
What I like about it is, so there's a particular language about the United States saying, we think we may have acted dishonorably, it doesn't use that word, but something similar, in the past. We've not always been true to our word, but hey, we want to wipe the slate clean.
So is this a fresh start? In these uncertain times, the U.S. clearly hopes so. Anita Powell, VOA News, Washington.
The South African government faces criticism at home for sending its Minister of Defense to Moscow to a Russian state-sponsored international security conference. The invitation to the event came from Russia's Defense Minister, General Sergei Shoigu, one of the architects of the Kremlin's war in Ukraine. South Africa's officials' attendance at the meeting in Moscow comes about a week after Pretoria hosted U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken. Darren Taylor has more.
South Africa's Defense Minister, Thandi Modise, previously came under fire for attending a cocktail party at the Russian embassy in Pretoria the day the Kremlin invaded Ukraine back in February. Now she's in Russia as a speaker at the 10th Moscow Conference on International Security. According to her department, Modise also will meet with her Russian counterpart.
This is consistent with South Africa's position, which is not taking sides with ongoing conflict and an independent foreign policy.
Professor David Monier, a political scientist at the University of Johannesburg's Africa Center, says Modise's attendance at the Moscow event isn't an endorsement of Russian aggression in Ukraine.
There's also a golden opportunity in conference of this nature in which South Africa would speak for itself and the continent on issues core to its interests and the continent, as well as try to mediate. And therefore, I think South Africa is making it quite clear it's an independent state. It will take any conference that tries to bring peace and security in the world.
But civil society organizations are questioning how Russia, which has invaded a sovereign country and killed and displaced thousands of civilians, is in a position to advocate for peace and security anywhere. One critic, Greg Mills, the director of the Brenthurst Foundation, an African development research group, calls the trip shocking and evidence of moral ambivalence and hypocrisy. The Center for Human Rights in Pretoria says the Russian trip is ill-advised and won't win South Africa many friends. The government says war is wrong, but it also says it's non-aligned when it comes to the conflict in Eastern Europe. Modise's statement says her government signed a number of military-related bilateral agreements with Russia to significant benefit of both countries. Monier says the same can be said with regard to South Africa's relations with some of Moscow's enemies.
There's been a number of military exercises and talk of American military in South Africa. It's ongoing. Last week, it was the other way around. Those who are leaning toward the East, China, Russia, would have said South Africa is part of Washington establishment.
Nevertheless, ask Pretoria's critics, should Modise's pre-conference statement have described Russia as one of the key players on peace and security on the African continent? They point out that Moscow's role on the military front in Africa recently has been to send what it calls private security forces from the Wagner Group to fight proxy wars in several nations. Monier says Modise's trip is an opportunity for her to raise some of the concerns about Russia's activities in Africa.
For instance, allegation of mercenaries in Central Africa or in Libya, where lots and lots of Russian armaments are being poured on the African continent. And I think we have to be as fair as we are with Westerners, where we disagree with them in terms of intervention in Libya in 2011 and other areas where we are not happy with their military bases on the African continent. We should equally raise those kind of issues with Russia in platforms like this in which the minister is attending.
South Africa's attendance of the Moscow event has been condemned in Ukraine. Its Parliamentary Foreign Relations Committee says South Africa has a reputation as a country fighting against racism. There is no need to ruin this reputation by such visits. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, and our engineer, Nelson Lopes, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station.